Okay, 10:45, we're going to go ahead and get started. My name is Sherry Wick, and I'm a tutor and working class studies at Youngstown State University. And for the purposes of this panel, it's useful to know that I'm also the editor of the Working Class Perspective blog, which comes out every week. And one of the roots of this panel is that blog. I actually want to begin the panel by talking a bit about its roots and its history and the kinds of conversations that I've been having with all of these people over the years that bring us all to the table. So I'm going to talk for a little while in setting this up, not a long, long while, maybe 7 or 8 minutes, and then turn it over to the rest of the panel. I'd ask all of them to keep their comments relatively brief because I really do hope that we can make this a true discussion, a true roundtable, not as it so often turn out to be a panel under any other name. So, as I said, this panel has roots in conversations that have been going on for a long time. In fact, I would argue that it has roots that go back to the first true working class studies conference we had in Youngstown in 1995, where, as I've written about in a couple of places, I was ready to walk away from working class studies as we went into that conference because it wasn't really what I was. And then at that conference, I had a series of incredible conversations with people about teaching working class students, which is what we do at Youngstown State. And that persuaded me that, in fact, I needed to stay and be involved in this movement. And I'm very grateful for all that movement that I did. Among the people I talked to way back in 1995 was Rennie Christopher. And Rennie and I continued a running conversation about teaching working class students and teaching in working class institutions for about 15 years now. One result of that was a summer institute we offered in 2006 on teaching that class. One of the conversations I had somewhere along the line was with some colleagues who work at institutes that just happened to be at research institutions that were exploring what they called intersectional studies, by which they meant race and ethnicity and gender. And the question I kept asking them is, well, why is a class part of that equation? And their answer was, because class is so hard to talk about. One of my responses to that response was to say, well, maybe what we need to do is bring people who teach college students together to talk about how to teach class so that it won't be so hard, because I actually don't think it's that hard to do. So we had an institute in 2006. That's where I met Nancy Burke, who is here from LaGuardia Community College, where she teaches English. I wasn't surprised that somebody from LaGuardia was interested, because my colleagues, the people I know at LaGuardia, have all been very interested in who their students are. And I think it's true for many community college faculty. Community colleges, unlike most other institutions in the country, seem to me to be thinking a lot about teaching working class students about what working class education means. So I wasn't surprised to meet Nancy there, and I'm not surprised to hear about the continuing interest in thinking about just the multiple identities that students bring into the classroom, and thinking about how class fits into that. Last October, I was invited to the University of Wisconsin as a guest of the Working Class Student Union. The Working Class Student Union is an entirely student-created, student-driven, student-run organization that intends to serve the interests and needs and provide support for working class students at what is, in fact, a very elite state university. I was blown away by this group of students, and I was especially blown away by China Fox, who is the young woman who organized it, who unfortunately can't be here. Among the great ironies of all of this is that China just graduated, and because she no longer is a student at the University of Wisconsin, she cannot use university funding to get her for a conference. And she's in that position of so many students graduating on trying to figure out, you know, now what? So she's unable to be here, but I can, if you're interested, talk to you a little bit later on about the kinds of things that the Working Class Student Union is doing. I was just so impressed at the idea that after spending 15 years talking with faculty about what working class students mean, to see working class students saying, in the absence of faculty who seem to be reaching out to help them, we'll do it for ourselves. Mm-hmm. And it's a pretty powerful, though I will admit, in some ways, struggling program. Just before I went to Wisconsin, I read an article on a new study on graduation rates, Crossing the Finish Line, Completing College in American Public Universities, which was written by William G. Bowman, Matthew M. Chingos, and Michael S. McPherson. Their book is not primarily about working class students. The class is one of the issues that they looked at, and they're defining class primarily by family income. As Jack can talk to us about, that's not always the best way to define it, but they needed a measure. Their findings really troubled me. I wasn't surprised to learn that working class students complete college in 6 years at a much lower rate than the middle class and upper class peers. I don't think any of us would be surprised at that. What concerned me was the finding that working class students who undermatch, that is, who choose to attend a working class institution, and I'll talk in a second about how we define that, rather than a more selective school, are less likely. Now, I've been an advocate of working class education and working class institutions for a long time. I define those as schools that not only serve significant numbers of working class students, but schools that embrace that mission in various ways, that offer programs to support working class students, that have a significant number of faculty and staff members who are conscious of the issues facing working class students. I had always made the assumption, based on everything I read about the experiences of working class students in higher education, that if they could be among peers who shared their background, so they wouldn't feel so out of place, and they wouldn't feel like they had to pass and pretend to be something that they weren't, that would make the college experience better. And if they had faculty and staff who understood all of that, they would get good support, and that would help them succeed. And what this report seems to suggest is that, in fact, those of us who teach at working class institutions are not doing as good a job for our working class students as we might. And that's what really got all of this started. I do want to say very briefly as an aside that part of that assumption about working class institutions came from my own students. I teach a graduate course every couple of years called Class and Culture. And one of the things we study in that course is class and higher education. And I've had a whole series of students in that course come into class and say, I'm reading these articles about this stuff, but that's not my experience at YSU at all. I feel very supported here. I feel very comfortable here. Most of my faculty members seem to understand what it means to be working class. This is clearly the right kind of place for working class students to be. Interestingly, one of those students who gave a paper on that very point at the Youngstown Conference sometime in the early 2000s is now one of my colleagues in the English department at YSU. So, brave enough, right? Reflecting on that study of Crossing the Finish Line and my experiences talking with the students at the University of Wisconsin, I wrote two blogs in which I speculated first about why working class students might not do as well as at working class institutions, talking about things like the fact that if you go to a selective institution, you may be more likely to be leaving home and going just far enough away that all of those ties to family that provide distractions, and the students who come into me and say, I'm sorry, I can't come to class for the next 2 weeks because my sister just had a baby and I have to stay home and babysit the other kids. Mm-hmm. And we've all probably heard those mm-hmm. kinds of stories. If you go just a little bit further away, those distractions might not have quite as much power. There were other pieces of that speculation, but try to think about why would middle-class institutions work better. Several people said to me that one way of explaining that is not about the institution, but about the students. That despite having the same grade point average, the same ACT scores, there may be differences in how students see themselves among those who say, I want to go to Ohio State rather than go down the block to Youngstown State. And that also makes sense to me. But I also began to speculate about what is it that's going on at working class institutions that we might do differently to help those students better. And one of the things I looked at was a study produced by the Carnegie Foundation for the Advancement of Teaching that had done a project with community college faculty in California, where one of their conclusions was that students will do better if we challenge them more, we ask more of them. This, I thought, was an interesting conclusion. It's a troubling discussion that many of us have been involved in for a long time, about how do we balance support and understanding and accommodation of, I've got students who are working 40 hours a week and raising 3 kids, dealing with an alcoholic husband, whatever it is, how I balance my support for that with providing them with quality education. As Randy Christopher wrote in an article in Teaching Working Class 10 years ago, her experiences teaching at both elite and working class institutions persuaded her that we are cheating working class students at both places. We cheat them at elite institutions because we don't recognize who we are and we don't provide them with support. We cheat them at working class institutions because we don't ask very much. And that's a hard thing for us to think about. It also, got in a fight with Jack. No, I'm sorry. An argument. A mild disagreement. We don't fight very often, so when it happens, it's very dramatic. Jack Messer, who teaches at Roosevelt University in Chicago, who had been teaching primarily working class, mostly adult schools, for a very long time, and teaching them more recently courses in working class studies, as well as courses in writing and research and those kinds of things, had a different take on this. So, because Jack is also a regular contributor to the Working Class Perspectives blog, he wrote a blog responding to that, and that was the point where I started thinking, well, maybe we should have a panel and talk about all of this.
And him stuck up for you.
Well, it's a great thing. It's a Francisco. So, one of my colleagues at Youngstown State University, where he works in teaches literature, journalism, and is also a member of the Center for Working Class Studies. So like me, he works with a lot of working class students. As it turns out, in fact, because China can't be here, all of us are coming from working class institutions. Like Jack, and I don't know about Nancy's family background, Tim's own path took him from a working class background into higher education, into the professorial middle class. He responded to all of this discussion and to some work that they're doing at YSU in the journalism program by writing, together with Melissa Lenhoff, who was here yesterday, a fabulous piece on the practices of journalism education that include the assumption that every student will do an internship. That it would be great for YSU students to go off to Washington, D.C. and do an internship to learn how to be a journalist, talking about how that kind of thing creates obstacles for working class students. I moved offices 2 years ago over to the other side of the English department, so Tim is now my neighbor, which is one of the great benefits of having moved that in the window of my office. And I spent a lot of time over the last year talking about these issues, and both of us have spent a lot of time talking with our students about these issues. So our roundtable brings together people with experience as working class students, people with experience teaching working class students. More importantly, I think all of us are thinking on multiple levels. We're thinking about what happens in our own classrooms. We're thinking about what's happening in our institutions. We're thinking about what's happening in educational and policy more generally. Let me say just a couple of things before I hand this over to all of them. One is that I think we can't overlook the timing of this discussion. We're in the middle of a national conversation about education in which the standing assumption is that everyone should go to college. And the standard response to the recession is that more and more people are flooding into colleges. Many of our institutions, Youngstown State just announced on Wednesday that they expect to have enrollment over 15,000, the highest it's been in 20 years. At the same time, other things are happening. In Youngstown, in the state of Ohio, you're just in the process of changing the funding formula for higher education. But up until now, the funding formula has been the institution gets money from the state based on how many students are there on day one, actually on day 14. First, in other words, it's in the interest of the institution to get as many students in the door, and we don't have nearly as much interest in getting them out the door successfully. And I think that is an issue across the board. We're seeing lots and lots of working class students, lots and lots of older displaced workers coming to college because college looks like the answer. As Jack and I have both written about in Working Class Perspectives, if you look at the statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics about the job categories that are predicted to have the most growth over the next 30 years. Out of the top 30, something like 21, do you remember the number?
Yeah.
Something like 21 are jobs that do not require college education. The future of the working class are also low wage and in most cases non-union jobs. But we're saying to everybody, come to college. And as I spent a lot of time spring semester discussing with graduate students and seniors at YSU who are getting ready to graduate, in many cases with a whole lot of debt and no prospect of a job, why did I do this? Was going to college in fact the right thing for me to do? At the same time as all of that is going on, the economy is leading most of our institutions to be facing major budget cuts. So there's a political picture that surrounds all of this. All of that generates several questions for us to consider. The broad question of the panel, what do our students need in higher education? Should parents, can parents, and guidance counselors more importantly, be advising working class students to pursue education in working class institutions, or should they be pushing them to other more selective schools? Should we, as college teachers, especially those working primarily with working class students, challenge them more? And if so, what does that look like? What is the right way to do that if we think that that's what we should do? Should we create more working class friendly programs within schools of all kinds? If so, what should they look like? And how do we make them work as well as they possibly can? How do we deal with the obstacles that our students face? Things like internships, as Tim looked at, I think are really important things, so that our working class students can get the most out of college that they possibly can. And how do we deal with that paradox that we're telling everybody that they should go to college when we know that in fact there's not going to be jobs for all? At that point, I'm going to turn it over to you.
I originally told people on the panel that I was going to talk about teaching class literacy. And then I started thinking about whether I'm successful at that. And I kind of want to problematize that by saying that at my institution, it's hard to talk about a working class for a number of reasons. I also was inspired to talk about community college because for those of you who have been at Dean, the AAP magazine, they have their special issue for this issue is on community colleges. And a review essay, Christina Stern, one of the people who's writing here, offers a description of who attends community college. Is there anything here who teaches community college? And so you all may be able to then problematize what I'm saying about this or relate to that. This is her description of who goes to community college. Students who want job training, students who seek to transfer to four-year colleges, and students who need remedial classes. Mm-hmm. So I read that and I said, but who and what does this description leave out? Probably 70% of my college. Add to this synthesis, students with origins in 120 different nations, who speak 80 different languages, who are 68% female, who have annual household incomes under 20,000. This is the profile of LaGuardia Community College in Queens, New York, where I teach. While community college students come largely from working class communities, class politics are complicated by this multiple service role that Christina Stern describes, and then the background of my students complicates it even more. And so everything's complicated by the role that they play. The classroom, however, is where we see something else added to the already complicated mix. Students are distracted by these multiple roles, their own lives take. They are parents, full-time workers, they are Iraq war vets, we just started the VETS program, which is very challenging, or have physical and cognitive disabilities. I just have three deaf students that I worked with this semester who are actually great to work with. They are chronically broke or have suffered loss of employment or housing eviction. And also, they're not students who will easily roll off. I was thinking of the Rahm Emanuel's slip when he said conveyor belt community colleges or conveyor belt education. They probably are going to get stuck in the years, which is what bothers me. I don't want to talk too much about the Obama stuff. I thought that maybe I would. The thing that bothered me about this whole conveyor belt language, business, vocation, labor production, all the things that the government wants to put into, is that I want my classroom to be a place where students become critical and reflect upon the sentence, reflect upon how this language of what they're supposed to be doing with patients within a staff, just people, students, and people who have lives. While variety in my classroom every semester produces wonderful dissonance, the challenge is to get them to think about the ways that their communities have been marginalized. In the public imagination, the community college is still a school of last resort, rather than an institution that educates nearly half the undergraduate population in the United States. And can they make the connection between the public's perception and their own understanding of themselves as class citizens because of where they attend college? Now, they're not. One of my students the other day was, I think, probably taking the class that I teach for the third or fourth time, has told me that she really likes Laguardia because of the Ivy League community college. And I was really trying to figure out where that rhetoric came from. I don't know if she knew, but that interested me nonetheless. For example, they are not, and this is one of the things that was interesting about my students, the University of New York, which Laguardia is a part of, started to educate the sons and daughters, although, the high-minded or whatever, sons and daughters of student working classes. And I think my students are aware of that when they fill out their application, and that's interesting to me. And I find that interesting also because my students see themselves as largely middle class. Queens is considered to be a middle class borough. And I get them talking about this. And one of the things that I find out is that, well, they live in houses. They don't live in housing projects. Right? Even if they pay rent, they live in a single, double family house. They don't live in a project. They work at Starbucks with profit sharing. Rather than Burger King. Because they get them these essays about, Fast Food Nation, and they're like, I did that junior high, whatever. And moreover, they are going to college, but our statistics is that our graduation rate is 26% within 6 years. So they're in this conveyor belt of, I'm not sure what. I try to teach class literacy with subjects like food, technology, gender, and now the economic recession and social mobility. In this past semester, students painfully slogged their way through op-ed pieces by my favorite working class liberal, Bob Herbert, by Holly. I like Holly Sklar's Zenith post because she always puts out statistics, and that they're also trying to, a lot of them just come out of the media map or the TV map, so I want them to get their calculators out and do stuff with that. And then also Fast Food Nation is their favorite line to teach. Many of the students resist the in-depth analysis of Herbert and Sklar's doomsday scenarios about the growing gap between the rich and the rest of us. And the topic of upsets them, it depresses them, it's too close to home, they don't want to know, they don't want to know because they refuse to read the casualties of the recession. Mm-hmm. They're at the Ivy League Community College, and they're going to become Beyonce and Jennifer Hudson. But I have an interesting tension that I want to close, the jury is out, they get this. We talk about this, I try to bring it in. I feel bad because I make them feel bad, but I want them to. am I a fixatist? Did I do it? Or is it, do I really need help? I'm still working on it. I'm working on that. And it makes me think of my favorite class this semester and two students on opposite ends of the pole, both young men of color, but from very different approaches to what they want out of life. Hayden, a Caribbean-American man, is in his early 20s, left trade school to come to LaGuardia because why make $40,000 a year as a car mechanic when you can work on Wall Street and make millions? He did get an A in my class. He's very, very smart and ambitious, but, is he going to get to his job on Wall Street and make billions? Are there going to be other things that are going to get in the way? And then there's Sam, totally opposite end of the perspective. Sam's his classmate, and he was this semester's only self-identified socialist. He was very proud of that fact and let me know about it in several essays. Sam's perfectly happy getting that two-year degree because he's joined the wait list for the Department of Sanitation job, one of the best union jobs in the city of New York. Okay, but the waiting list is 3 years long. So don't put the eggs in one basket, as the saying goes. I've got 2 years. I'm going to get my degree. So Sam questions Hayden's choice. You know, why is he doing this? This is actually a direct quote. This is Sam questioning Hayden. Man, you're going to step on all of us on your way up, and then when you arrive, avoid paying those taxes that help the rest of us out. And then Hayden's response was, well, no. I mean, come on, man. I've got a conscience. I'll leave you with that.
But the other thing is,
as an adult, as a teacher of working adults, these are people who went 6 months to a community, one semester at a community college here, went off to the state university for a year there, you know, did terrible, and, you know, and often brilliant people, you know, you look at their transcript, and it's these, and after, you know, and, you know, I was one of those because it died. So, lifelong learning, you know, it just seems to me that the focus on 18 to 22 is misplaced. I don't know what to do about it, but it's not necessarily the best time to be. That's one thing. The other thing is teaching younger people. The stakes are so high, and with adults, the stakes are not as high. They know, you know, and this goes to the aspiration. They do not think they're going to go well. They know the next position they want to get to, or, you know, the Ford worker is getting a computer science degree just in case the plant closes down. And it didn't close down, so he never used the degree. But, you know, they're much more realistic. And if anything, they might be a little on the low aspiration side. With which I'm okay. That's sort of what I want to focus on. So that's my background and the background of Roosevelt. The Sherry's concern. I forgot. When did I start?
You're fine. You can, don't worry about it.
Sherry's concern was with undermatched students, and I feel like. And the question we should challenge them more. I feel like I do a good job challenging the middle students, not the high end. And so for high end young people, I can see if we might not be serving them well, but they're with adults. I need that. I don't want to, they can't. They're not in a situation where they can go to any university and go to a selection. But I need those high-end students to help the middle. And I like to use, I'm not pursuing excellence, and I'm not suggesting that the students pursue the excellence. I want to get them to mediocrity. That's large. And many working class students, and I've heard you say this, and there's a good passage, and I can't think of it. I just want to be average.
But they don't know what average is.
So, well, that's not average, this is average. That, now you're up here, but this is average. So, and it seems to me that is it's an aspiration to be average that, demands respect and needs to be respected. Now, the thing about aspiration, and this would get into a Obama discussion. It's like the way the discussion is being conducted, and Obama is as bad as anybody, and he and Michelle's background is, they aspired and shot for the top and got to the top. But the discussion is conducted as if you don't get a college education, you're worthless. Now, not anything that Obama or Arne Duncan would say worthless, but the discussion is conducted like that. And 2/3 of the jobs are not going to require an associate degree.
Right.
It's a bewitched kind of discussion. And what Sherry said, we need in your blog, create a stronger atmosphere of achievement. That's, in my sense of things, that would be the very worst thing for us to do at Roosevelt. Because universities, what we're doing is acclimating students, acculturating them to middle-class culture, middle-class values. And many of those values, like demanding evidence when people say things, and, you know, all the things that the writing skills, communication skills, and thinking, critical thinking skills, all those are middle class types of things, but there's a culture that goes with it. And we don't need to, and the part of that is this achievement orientation and succeeding to be the best, and excellence. Excellence means you've got to be better than somebody else. Being good, you can be, you know, and I think most people aspire to be good, and it has an ambiguity. It means, hey, I did a good job, but it also has a moral and an ethical, So that just sort of hit my butt. But so I'm reading this book, and this, it's called The Spirit Level. It's British social science, Marmon. What they show, all these different countries, advanced countries, just advanced countries, and then different states in the United States, they have measures for inequality of income. And the United States is number one in inequality of income among these 15, 20 countries. It's number one in homicide, anything bad, it's way down in longevity, people don't live as long. And this is not, in all kinds of prisoners, and it's not only us, UK is number two, and then Portugal. And Japan is always the best at stuff. So there's range. But it's not that poor people, because we have more poor people, it's not that longevity is lower just for the poor people, dragging the average down. It's across the board. Dope addiction, whatever it is, it affects all the classes, except that they can't tease out the top 5%. So that they may not affect them, but it affects the top 20%. You know, so we have worse outcomes here. And all I know is it's correlation. Okay, so one of the things that they found, this is sort of a throwaway line, but I think it's very surprising, that in the less equal countries on income, people have higher aspirations. And in the more equal countries, they have lower aspirations. More unequal, where there's greater inequality of income, like the United States, there is a bigger gap between aspiration and the reality, a realistic expectation. So put that all together, and I think you could say that, what was his name, that this is having high aspirations could be a sign of mental illness. I
would have to follow.
So one of the things I think we can do for sports, but one, directly address class, and I recommend that I have to read Barbara's this book, I forget it's published, but Barbara Jensen's work, and Unequal Childhood around the world. And it's just, Jeff's thinking about these class relationships, there's an identity aspect to it. So talking about those things and legitimizing the working class side of it. So I just have one more little piece of data. There's social scientists do this where they give a phrase like businessman, union leader, middle class, poor, women, etc. And they're like 30. Yes, and it's a temperature. So how warm do you feel? Like, 80, 90, 70. It's just reacting to a phrase. Guess what phrase comes in number one at like 90% on the thermometer? You feel the warmest about working class. Now, that's, you know, in terms of classism and working class as a word resonates with people. But on the working class, and I don't know why that's the case with middle class people, but with working class, there's a working class pride that, you know, we do the work, the kind of together, the kind of daily solidarity and things like that, that we need to tap into, legitimate at the same time as we are unashamedly presenting, you know, union middle class culture. It, Roosevelt, it's a long time ago, but would blacks learn standard English? You know, it was like, were we calling that? You know, that was this whole discussion. But we got to do that. We got to, you know, if people are motivated to learn, we've got to do that middle class thing. But it doesn't mean we have to dishonor working class culture. That's my way. Sorry.
Well, I would agree, and now I'm opposed. Very briefly, since you're doing institutional profiles, and Sherry, one of the things when you mentioned Ohio educational policy, which is part of my focus here, how state-level educational policy defines education and inadvertently defines what working class students do with that education. But what you did mention was the new climate performance,
Right. Which
is now based on students' success.
Yeah.
And what that means is graduation rates. So we've gone from a really problematic formula in the state of Ohio that is about a body count, right, to one that arguably could lead to subsidized rate inflation. Because now there's increased pressure on the institutions that everyone, an F does not count as success under the new formula, nor does a D, I don't know, right? So that's an even bigger problem, because frankly, what is the value of that credential when this system is in place, which is partly what I want to talk about today, credentials and value systems and that kind of stuff. Very briefly, and this is old data I didn't look up, this is from another paper that I happen to have on my laptop, and you all are talking about institutional data. I think this is from 2006, this data, and Sherry, you may have different data, but the census statistics report that family poverty levels in Youngstown, Ohio are more than 30% citywide. Average household income is among the lowest in the nation. The Youngstown area until about a year ago did not have a community college. Arguably, we still don't. They kind of cobbled together this program that doesn't have a budget. It's like, here's a bunch of classes, a headquarters,
right,
and this is a community college. So part of what we're doing is assuming the community college functions at YSU. But we're also doing master's and a couple of PhD programs as well. So it's frankly the most bizarre institution, I'll be honest with you, I have ever been, in good and bad ways. Nearly 85% of our students receive financial aid as of 2006. I would think it's higher now. And 56% are enrolled in remedial classes in the first year, which is a pretty high number. I teach in two different areas, and I want to bring that up because a dinner conversation I was having last night with some people, we were talking about the different sets of expectations students have based on my content areas. I teach in journalism, I'm kind of a cross appointment, but I also teach Shakespeare, which is actually what my PhD is, okay? And I find wildly different expectations in those two areas. In my Shakespeare class, I can pretty much, without fear, say, okay, you have to read this, you have to read that. And there's an assumption that I'm right. I know it's good for them. To an obscure body of knowledge. Okay. My journalism students, it's a different story. It's constantly, why do we have to do that? How does that lead to this? Which is frankly what you want from journalism. I'm not sure how that works in the context of what I want to talk about here, but it's just something that came up in dinner conversation. Very briefly, I guess, a couple of things that Jack brings up, and I think you're right, even though I didn't, when we had this discussion in the blogs. But what I think you're right in doing is attending to the fact that for better or worse, the language of the values of the middle class are the language and values of economic opportunity. And I think it would be remiss to gloss over, you know, that fundamental. I agree with you that we need to value working class production. But I wonder how we do that in an economy that you don't know what it's going to look like when our students graduate, particularly right now. What does it mean to be working class? Wall Street Journal a couple of weeks ago had a great article on these people who digitize documents for a living, right? Well, policymakers would say, hey, that's great high-tech work, but it's not. It's no different from piecework on an assembly line, okay? One of the things that I've been interested in, the things that I've spouted off to share about, is the way that educational policy at the state and national level privileges, for lack of a better word, a vocational focus in higher education. And I would argue that that actually puts working class students at a disadvantage. I went to, myself, an open access university. And I don't know whether that's relevant or not, but I think when we look at things like the State of El Paso Strategic Plan, which frankly adopts the rhetoric, and it's online if any of you want to look at it, of consumer and producer, unabashedly, education is a product. And as in many states, the focus in Ohio is on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics degrees, and resources are allocated towards those programs. They're in very disproportionate amounts, despite the fact that in our department, we teach the most students of anyone, okay? When you look at reports like that, when you look at public policy, I think it sets up a couple of expectations for students from working class backgrounds. The purpose of education becomes a career, and it becomes a career that should be defined early on, and everything should be geared toward that end. So it becomes very, very vocational, okay? The problems with that, as I see it, and I'm just kind of speculating here, but I guess I should say that in my former life, I came to academics very late. I didn't earn my doctorate when I was 41. Before that, I was a business and finance reporter. And what I know about economics and diversified economies is somewhat contradictory to what I see in the emphasis for the STEM fields. A recent Rutgers study, for example, I don't know how many of you saw this, it's in the Chronicle of Higher Education, documented that contrary to these calls that are put out by politicians at state and national levels, we actually have a glut in STEM graduates. It makes us too many, okay? The reason that they're not going into the STEM fields, particularly engineering, is because, whether inadvertently or, you know, intentionally, universities have helped to create a labor surplus in those fields. Okay? That makes the onus on the corporations to offer attractive incentives at entry-level engineering positions less. So increasingly, these students are going to other fields. They're going to management and consulting. And that really rung a bell. Why management? Why consulting? Why go there? Well, one reason is the money. Okay? But I think another reason has to do with the generational shift that public policy is not accounting for. And I think when we think about students at all levels, including working class students, we're thinking about students who have grown up with new media, who have grown up with fallen models of information, fallen models of economy and economics. And these are students who are more comfortable with what I'm going to very broadly label entrepreneurial spirit. Okay? Even in an intellectual way. So that, for example, while we are telling them the path is here to here, right, what we should be telling our students is the path is frankly unknowable. You don't know where this is going to take you. So I'm going to propose that what working class universities need to do is teach intellectual entrepreneurship. And that is that we need to think about ways. I need to think about ways, for example, that the discussions of class that inform my Shakespeare class, right? Also, find common threads in what I'm teaching in editorial and opinion or against reporting. I'm going to take issue and argue that it is about critical thinking. It's about connecting disparate areas of knowledge in ways that we are uniquely positioned to do in working class institutions. Because many of us, like myself, come from very diverse backgrounds. We're coming to academics after careers in other disciplines. And more often than not, and I think many of you can attest to this, we're teaching a different subject area. I mean, on a different day, on any given day, I'm going from teaching advanced reporting, where I'm teaching multimedia, video, and reporting, right, to 16th century British literature. Well, the only way to stay sane and productive is to find the commonalities between those disparate areas of knowledge, right? And I think that the best service that we can do for our students in that sense is to teach intellectual entrepreneurship. I say, okay, you know, maybe this four-year degree isn't going to lead to a job in journalism, okay? But it may lead you to public policy. It may lead you to a great career in marketing. It may lead you in places that you never had imagined. And I think that our students, while initially are resistant to that, there are ways that you can show them that they are uniquely prepared for that kind of education. Look at what you're doing. You are a mother, and you are working at Starbucks, and you're a student, right? What are the points of connection? How do you draw those experiences together, and how do they translate to what are extremely marketable skills? And I realize that this sounds incredibly utopian and optimistic, particularly for me, because I'm generally, So here's where I'll get to the negative part. The other thing I think is that we have to be honest, because a lot of what I'm saying is utopian. And I'm giving the classic liberal humanist argument, right? That education is good for you, it prepares you for a life of the mind, and makes you an infinitely better, more happy person. And I think maybe we should disclose that there is no guarantee that that is going to happen. What I do think we need to pull away from, particularly in institutions like ours, and this is where I do get cranky, is this aligning our curriculum with the needs of business and industry, which is very much part of our strategic plan. Because the needs of business and industry are too rapidly changing. And frankly, you know, we can push out as many STEM degrees as possible, but what are we training them to do? Are we training them to be those people that digitize on the digital assembly line, essentially, right? Or do we want to teach the people who are going to be the innovators, right? Who's going to be the one that comes up with the next big idea? We don't get that, at least, and I'm going to speak to our institution, the way we're going now. I mean, I think we're headed profoundly in the wrong direction. And when public policy, and this is actually in the Ohio Strategic Plan, identifies as a measure of success an annual survey of business and industry and how well-prepared graduates are to enter a given vocation, there's something terribly wrong, and it's something that I think will ultimately be incredibly oppressive for working class people. So there's my anger and my
bitter. Thank all of you for your comments, and it's now your turn. We have a little over half an hour for questions, comments, your stories. I'll start right here.
Thank you to all of you. I'm from Chicago as well, so you can go yourself and get things that you do there. One of the, after listening to everyone's viewpoint, I am a high school teacher. I do believe that what you are getting is truly a byproduct of what they are getting at the elementary level and the high school level.
Yes.
What you just explained is no school's ideology for exploratory learning. Mm-hmm. Most inner city schools don't have middle school. So exploratory learning happens if you're in a small town that has a middle school. And then, so we have them from kindergarten through 12th grade, and some schools are not challenging students to think. They're not challenging them to be innovative. They're not challenging them to do anything other than do what they're told. And then they get to college and they're supposed to sit in a Shakespeare class or sit in a gen ed social awareness class and discuss FAFSA Nation. We teach FAFSA Nation as freshman year. And they read Nickel and Dime freshman year, along with FAFSA Nation. And there's no real discussion because they're teenagers and they're silly. And it's too much classroom management, and so a lot of teachers don't bother. They put the worksheet together, you answer these questions, okay, parents share, and we move on. So there's no real deep discussion about why you had five McDonald's on the way to school today. And why is it that when McDonald's was renovated, you didn't eat dinner? And the day that it reopened, you would have thought it was, you know, Great America reopening or something. So I think the disconnect is we have decoded them by the time they get to you, and you're trying to plug them up again, and by the time they get plugged up, they're 30 in your lap. So in that time span, they're not motivated to speak up at work. They're not motivated to vote. They're not motivated to go to their child's school and speak up about what the child is learning, because they don't know what they didn't get, and they don't know what their child should get. And so it's a constant play of catch-up. So at this point, you know, I do agree that there needs to be more rigor at the college level, and I have students who are pregnant. I've got students who just had kids. I've done homeschooling for a kid who had her entire body. She had 8 degrees in the last 2 years, and she had more get up and go than the kids who actually every day with every network is at five. And so her being detached from the regular school day motivated her to do more, and I can drop off work to her and it's done in the day or two, and I can give students in my classroom 2 days to do an assignment, and they come in with 5 million excuses. So I want to know, what do you see the correlation between high school and elementary school, and how is higher ed addressing, you know, the product that you're receiving? I don't think we're giving you a good hand to deal with it.
So then it's part of why so many of our students end up taking remedial courses because they're coming in and now having gotten that education. It seems as if we all understand that neither K-12 nor college education is working as well as it could.
Right.
And we haven't yet figured out the solutions. And I think the move towards tech and forms of objective assessment, which we're battling on higher education. Well, I would take issue with the idea of evidence-based, because I think you can do evidence-based assessment that is not standardized tests. I understand that, but there are ways of assessing student learning that generate really good conversations about teaching and improvement in education, and there are ways of doing it that are not doing it as random testing. But we're having this discussion, we've been having, and you're right.
I also think one of the big problems is that a place like a community college, here's what you described, sounds like my atmosphere in my class, for instance. And a lot of it is that community colleges faculty teach 30 hours, you know, lucky we teach 20 hours, and we're told that's a gift, and we shouldn't try to argue for less. And the state colleges, we teach 24. And yet we are in the battlefield with all these issues, and we should be the ones producing the research on it. But we have no time. We can't. We have no time. And we get no support for it. Nobody's time. There's no grant. Nobody can help us write grants. All that stuff. And that really, our working class students also suffer
from that. So there was a hand here. There's one over there. There's one here. There's one over here. I will try to get to everybody. Starting with us.
I have a couple comments. One is about apprenticeships. One of the things that I think for a lot of working class kids right now, and I use kids broadly, is to think about apprenticeships. I was at a conference in Tennessee last year, and the state of Tennessee, people in the state of Tennessee, probably labor were there, trying, they were trying a new web portal to try to encourage students to go into apprenticeships, and here are the things that are good about them. You get paid while you're learning. The education is free. There are tons of jobs. A lot of people are retiring from construction, trade positions, and there's nobody in the pipeline. Not only do you get paid while you are learning, while you're an apprentice, you earn enough credits at community colleges now to end up with basically an associate's degree, and that's paid for. So you come out with no debt, you come out making, I think they pay about $30,000 or $40,000 as your apprentice. And the pay, some of these trades you need to learn higher level math, you need to learn physics. So it's you really come out with very high level skills, and once you're you're earning $100,000. So it's not $1 million, so chop off a zero. So that's, I think, where a lot of people should be going. You can lead a pretty satisfactory life with that. Second, I just wanted to talk about why do I teach in a law school. And one of the things that I do a lot is explain the process of education. So I tell them, this is what we're going to do today, and this is why we're doing it. And this is how this fits together. And as an incentive, just so you know, I test what I teach, and I test how I teach. So I spend a lot of time pushing them to do analysis, which is hard, even at the law school level. And I do this because, as somebody who came in to undergraduate education and doing it in law school, and I ended up going to a big public law school, I felt very alienated. And some people have secrets to success because they came from their families, they were connected to lawyers, they knew how to take the test, they knew what mattered. And so I try to take away that advantage and make sure everybody is on a level playing field as much as possible. So I think that's something that's important for working class students, for those of us who managed to come out of not be working class, but come from working class. Our minds are somewhat, I think, we're corrupted. But we lose that perspective of what they don't know. And maybe we somehow have crutches along with it and help us get there. But we need to make certain that people know exactly what's happening, even if it's totally repetitious and lost in the knowledge.
Yes, I teach in the California State University system, and we have been hit by a double whammy of the worst budget cuts in our history. We've had to turn away students. This is disproportionately affecting students of color and students of moderate income. We've also been hit by our administration, which is pushing a model that sounds very much like what Ohio is doing, that's called, for lack of a better term, deliverology, which they are measuring outcomes as if we're turning out widgets. Much of what this panel is talking about is quite relevant and very interesting. But as I sit here trying to process all of this, what came to mind is this roundtable asks, what do working class students need? And I think the question's incomplete. To what end? I mean, how can we define what they need unless we ask to what end? And it seems to me that we're trying to define success by what business wants and by what the state wants, which are often, running on parallel tracks. But if I might draw on the traditional liberal idea of education, does it really liberate our students to funnel them in these directions and then define as success those who matriculate in a certain period of time? So I think we need to ask even more fundamental questions, especially at this conference where we're talking about the ways in which capitalism fundamentally denies people liberation. So I just wanted to throw that out
there. Yeah, and I'll hand over here to Malcolm.
Well, I just wanted to pick up from what we started with in the morning, too, it's right-wing ascendancy, that is a virulent anti-intellectual tone of the whole culture is playing out in really disturbing ways. That I do a lot of work with different kinds of colleges, and I would say that the business model for the college of the future is no tenure. The only way you get a job at a university is if you can get a corporate sponsor and you can establish that what you're going to teach is going to show somebody how to make money. And these kids are just like little marbles in the shoes. They are running there. They want to know why they have to learn that. What does that have to do with making money? Don't bother me with your Shakespeare. I don't need to know that stuff. And at the University of North Florida, if you change your major after your first year, you're not eligible for student aid.
What?
Once you're in the shoes, you're supposed to stay there. They brought marketers onto campus and had students evaluating professors. And on the basis of those student evaluations, they tried to get rid of about one-third of the faculty at the University of North Florida. And my favorite story of late was the legislature in Florida met, and they needed to make budget cuts. And they knew an across-the-board budget cutter and across-the-board tuition hike was going to be very unpopular. So they sat in the back room. Can you imagine these morons? They go, well, what, you know, what's math? Oh, we need math. Well, anthropology, what the hell is that? Well, I think that's where they teach evolution. Let's get rid of it. They abolished anthropology throughout the state of Florida at the college level. I mean, they were able to get it back in. But we're dealing with something far bigger than energized working class students. The whole academia is so under fire now.
Very quickly. In the Ohio and in our own institution, the new emphasis is to allocate resources to programs that demonstrate economic development, which with my limited background in economics, I've always challenged people, show me the model that you're going to use that shows that this program generates economic development. You know, what does that mean? How are you defining it? So that's part of the rhetoric that we're dealing with there, you know, part of that logic.
That's not what Andy said the other way. Every program I ever taught in that was any good was crushed. Or abolished.
Which I suppose is a sign of success.
I taught in some working class things in some rather extreme conditions. I would be called over to the I'd be called over to the police station to recruit my students. I taught sex offenders, just as they were coming out. And if they didn't do anything, two out of three went back to jail. And if they went through my class successfully, only one out of three went back to jail. So I got into some very tough conditions with very little support. But we still had a number of very good successes. And the key things, I think all turn back to Faraday and the pedagogy of the oppressed. Everybody should keep reading all of you, and that's the point exactly about motivation. I had a guy who spent 25 years in jail who was my co-teacher, and he would start off motivating students by telling them they were all worth $30,000 if they didn't do anything. That's what they were worth as a piece of meat if they went back into the system. That's what the prison industrial complex would make off of them. And if they did nothing, that's exactly what would happen. So that was the way we got their attention, not motivation. I thought my particular program was to teach people to get industrial certifications to repair computers and install networks. But all of the prisoners knew that even if they could do it well, they didn't wouldn't necessarily get hired. So I had to teach in entrepreneurship. And I had to teach people how to go into business on their own. And how part of the learning was how to make happy customers and satisfy customers. And that you couldn't get over them. The most important thing I think I had to teach was how to learn. Because if I said everything I'm teaching you here about how to pass this test in 5 years is obsolete. So Well, it's not going to do you any good to memorize or to just, you know, memorize something so you can get in there and pass the test. You can pass the test, passing the test and getting your certification will get you hired, but not knowing how to fix computers will get you hired. And it's constantly changing. And so the most important thing I have to do is teach people how to learn on their own without needing to go over their shoulders. So those are the critical thinking skills. And lifelong learning skills that you have to draw out in all of these working class students. I think, I don't think something has to, the only belongs in middle class, but the quality of a good teacher is somewhere in your student's consciousness. Some of the core of these ideas are there, and your task as a teacher is to help them find, draw them out and help them find it. In some cases, you will be successful, in some cases, you won't. But believe me, one thing I've learned is all the simple answers are wrong. About, you know, testing this or, you know, class size, this, all the simple answers are wrong. They're complex, the problems you face are complex, the working class education are very complex and very difficult.
Yeah, just a quick comment and a question. I think we have to do more to link between K through 12 teachers and collegiate teachers, especially at the level of our unions, because race to the top, which affects the K through 12, we have to organize seriously against that legislation. It is legislation to privatize our school system, and we must do more in that area. But I also, and I think we should propose a panel next year how to significantly organize together to do that. My question is about linking this idea of challenging students educationally with this notion of expectation. And I think traditionally our expectations, I think we need to find different ways to do that following something like Freire, and I don't know how to do it. I'm just wondering from the panel or others, what are some ways to do that? Because I think whether it's attending or doing the reading or taking the test or writing the paper, these still are very traditional models that reinforce, I think, middle class values, but also our students still as working for someone else.
Well, it does depend on the something different. I suppose required different kind of thing. It depends on, I mean, it's built in many ways to how we teach. I mean, even things like, you know, do they do the reading, do they not do the reading? Well, there's lots that we can do to get them to do the reading. And, you know, part of what I mean is giving me the opportunity to explain yet again to Jackie when I say achievement, I don't mean everybody becomes the best. I mean, everybody can become average, but the expectation to say, all of you can do that, and here's what it takes to do it. Some of it, I think, is about talking about education, is that talking about what does learning mean, so that we make clear to students how what we're doing now is different from what we're doing next year. And these are the things we expect of them. But as you were saying,
actually, with the now spreading across campus that I started, students take book rights, whatever they're reading, mathematics, science, we spread it across in voc ed tech every day, no matter what you write at the beginning of class. And it doesn't matter, it can be across the curriculum. And it's not rated in a way, it's a, you know, do it or not do it kind of assignment. If you do it, are you here doing it or do you not? And what my colleagues and I have found is that in doing that activity, it's getting students, you know, we're spending time with it, you know, we're not just quick write, okay, we're done, let's move on. We're doing shared, but then we're talking about it, all of us, too, small groups and then large groups. But it's spreading across the curriculum and it's starting to make a difference in students, and just keeping students active in reading, and then also in the process, teaching them about how to learn. And then we're, because of it, you know, do it or not do it, it erases all those points where we feel bad about what we do, or my talent's not perfect. It gets rid of all that.
Interesting. I mean, I've been in the labor movement for a long time. So everybody's up there talking about working class college. We don't use the word working class in the labor movement.
You're not lying.
And in society. We talk about maybe working families, or we talk about the labor movement having created the middle class. There is no working class.
Right.
And working class, when it gets used, like during the election, it was talking about white people. And that, I think, is fundamentally what happened in our history, is that that if you were to define things by class, as opposed to what our history did by race, then working class would, by definition, include black people, and now other people of color. And so we have defined ourselves as we have poor people who are black people, and now are Latino and other people of color. We have middle class people. We have upper class. We don't have working class people. There's no pride in being working class. If you go to Europe, people talk about being working class. That's like not a bad thing. And I think that that there is a tremendous amount of internalized oppression among working class parents. You can't feel good. You could be a machinist, but you fail because you're not middle class, whatever that means. And if you have a house in the labor movement, you're supposed to say that you're middle class, but you really don't feel that way. You know, we don't. And so I feel like just talking about the idea of that, what that notion of class, it challenges capitalism and our whole history. Like that, Michael Fly forced himself into the door of the AFL-CIO and convinced Trump to invite him so he could explain to them what the working class is and why we needed to use that word. I'm serious, you know. And they said thank you very much, and they still refuse. And it actually sounds like you're talking about some communist notion. When you say working class or working class solidarity, that's what you know. So I think that it's very tied up with our particular racist history. And I think that that subject and talking about that is probably a really good discussion to have with young people, because I don't think anyone ever talks about it.
So then the question becomes, where does that story get told? And I think Tim mentioned in his remarks, talking about the sort of, you know, having to tell, to explain to students, guess what? This liberal notion that we have of education is not always going to equate to the good life. And so in my area of communication and media studies, the story getting told in our transnational media conglomeracy, right?
Yeah.
The image that students come to school with, they know college education is about driving a Lexus, living on Rodeo Drive, the consumption patterns of our culture. And so they're working towards that. And when the education system follows behind it, whether it be K through 8 or secondary and into higher education, those grants that all of the academics have to get to pay for their research means that it's a commodity that they've got to provide. And it's, and you said, that's what you said, Tim. Tim said in his remarks, on the website, the description at Youngstown is this consumer description, right? You're coming here to buy a product, and we're going to help you make the purchase. And when you take your money, send you on your way. But it doesn't equate to the good life. And so I think what also has to happen in this discussion is finding ways to reclaim the relationship between a sense of self and education, right? That learning for learning's sake is about becoming a better person, whether you're a machinist or you're an accountant. This idea that what you know, what you do, aren't necessarily things that have to be linked more apart from separate.
I am from Canada, so I have a slightly different perspective. I'm also, I'm proud of it. I can have health care without worrying about going into debt. And I think part of the discussion is the fact that I see education as a social institution. In a social institution that's being forced into a neoliberal capitalist profit paradigm. And that is where the ideology clashes. So I also am a working person. I'm a single parent. I spent a couple of years building houses as a carpenter apprentice and couldn't do that any longer, so went back to school, and I'm finishing my master's in sociology, and I'm focusing on the work-life balance of residential construction workers, and passionate about it, so talk to me, talk your ear off about it. However, part of my duties at school is as a teaching assistant as well as a writing center consultant, and so I see students every day that shouldn't be in university. They are out of their league, and they feel horrible about it. So they are leaving university, whether or not they finish their 3 or 4 year degree, with this deflated sense of self-esteem. And so then I always want, I have this friend who always says, follow the money. The money will tell you exactly the purpose of everything in life. So I think about that, and what does the money tell me about producing a class of workers who have very low self-esteem and feeling that sense of failure? So whether you're a machinist, and I would like to speak to you about, or just comment in a minute about the apprenticeship thing. And really what I think it does is it predisposes in a generation of workers who is grateful for any kind of crappy job that's out there. That allows this work to be done, never questioning it, because you don't feel as though you have a right to aspire to a better position or a better social contract. And I think that for me is the big thing, is the social and moral contract between worker and employer has been decimated, in particular in the 80s, and I think we haven't really remembered that very significantly today, that legacy of the 1980s, where that contract was broken irrevocably, has left us with thinking that we're grateful for whatever kind of McDowell we can get. And please don't talk to me, you know, about, oh, you get a paycheck, so therefore you should be, you know, doing whatever I tell you to do. And we just had like a city workers in Mississauga. Mississauga is a suburb of Toronto. Come out online where they actually routinely duct tape workers. These are city employees, part of a union. They duct tape workers as a hazing initiation process, and that nobody there was reprimanded. Nobody lost their job. They're talking about this as just boys blowing off steam. Well, as a former construction worker, yeah, that actually does go on, and people, you know, don't say anything about it. And just about the apprenticeship thing, I wholeheartedly agree, but what the problem with that is, and as somebody who was in the trades, there is a loophole in the system of apprenticeship. Employers no longer have to hire Red Seal or fully qualified apprentice tradespeople to do a lot of the jobs, because just like every other sector of society, that also has been tailorized and you know, de-skilled, so you can hire somebody without a carpenter qualifications to do this part, as long as there's somebody who's normally the owner of the company that has that qualification. And so in our country, the government has tried desperately to get young people into the apprenticed occupations, and those young people who have tried to do that have been met with a brick wall, because you have to find your own employer to take you on as an apprentice. You have to go through a comprehensive 3 or 4 year training period where the employer is obligated to provide you with training in a wide variety of tasks within that particular trade. And with every level that you've completed, your pay scale goes up because it's graduated. And so what you'll find is you might get somebody to hire you as a first level apprentice. And then as soon as you do your first block of schooling, where you're out of the workforce for 8 weeks, you don't get back on a payroll anywhere. So I think we need to be realistic with young people in the opportunities that we're providing with them, and just let them know that they don't have to settle for these crappy jobs, and that they have a right to a decent livelihood, and it's a social and a moral contract between employer and employee. It's not, I give you money, you do what I tell you to do.
Very, very good. Several people lined up.
One thing this tells you is that the value of having apprenticeship programs that are negotiated with unions, and I'm not going to say more about it since there are people waiting, but that's the key.
Yeah, I just,
so thrilled to hear this conversation. It's just making me so happy. It's just, it's bringing together these things that are core challenges that we're struggling with right now. I grew up blue collar, my dad's a mechanic. I went off, you know, did the thing, rising up and out, right? Got the fancy education, fancy prep school, fancy, almost that elite education, that kind of thing. And then, totally by accident, stumbled aboard this Angie Fargo and now U.S. Coast Guard licensed marine again. Totally changed my life. And the process of learning, doing this homeland apprenticeship, which basically was informal, non-union, you know, completely separate informal apprenticeship, but I found myself so frustrated by all that I hadn't learned in school. I had taken, you know, by accident, some scheduling group because I was in the top classes, right, top, that's how it's better to be in the advanced this, that, as long as it's liberal arts. So I ended up in the electronics class by accident, you know, scheduling group for like a, you know, shop class or something. And that was the sum total of experience that I had in having physical relationships with the world around me. Mm-hmm. Because what's happened in this country is we've completely devalued. Anybody can wash their hands, anybody can come home from work dirty. Mm-hmm. And so you get that machinist. I just had a shaft rebuild. I'm sitting there with this machinist and I'm just like, he is saving my life. He is saving my life by putting this shaft together in the right way. And the skill and the attention and the mastery is so devalued in this country. That combined with the fact that I'm doing speaking all over, talking to different groups, some of them, you know, older and some of them college age, and talking about this challenge that we have. Not only have we devalued hands-on work, but we've also completely lost sight of the fact that college education is not the ticket. Exactly what people are talking about. And I think the stat is 40% of all students who start don't finish, don't get a degree within 6 years. Which means they're graduating that failed student, you know, that somehow, you know, defeated, somehow deficient, and I'm now in debt. And I don't have a degree. The degree is not the ticket anyway, right? But I don't even have a degree, and I'm in debt, and I failed. And so when I take my job, that's, you know, something, hopefully, at some point, somebody told the student, actually, you can have a really successful, really good life, happy, well balanced by working hands, by working the trades, right? But I just, that message is not, it's not translating. Although I will say that it's really exciting, and I can give people citations if you haven't seen these things. In mainstream media, there's a great article called Case Against College Education. Sorry, no disrespect, but it analyzes these issues. Part of the But so there was that, and that was in 1995. And then Plan B was a piece that was just in the Times recently, right? So this conversation is starting to happen, and the failures are being identified, and I just am so grateful.
There's also Richard Sennett's book, Crash, where he actually does the whole thing.
I agree, this has been just so extremely effective. The question, I've been putting my hand up, and now the question I want to ask has changed every time. It's not a question anymore, it's more an observation of going back to the title of what the work best in the higher education. And seeing, I'm hearing that it's a space in our classrooms for considerations of class and what it means and where we, you know, where it comes from, how the term is deployed and included in what we're doing here in this classroom and how it plays out in higher education. And that would be a space that would contain maybe or play out this radical contradiction work that was just wonderful to hear between Tim and Jack in terms of, you know, for Tim, intellectual entrepreneurship. And Jack's notion that, you know, that aspiration or this sort of the desire to get rich is almost like an infantile disorder. And it goes right to Nancy. So those are two working class students, one of whom wants a union job in the sanitation department, and the other one's a job on Wall Street. So to somehow have that articulate that, and I teach working class literature, so that's a space where that can be front and center all the time through the various representations of class experience in history and now. But I think that would be up to it. So it would include, too, I just need to say this, the discussion is always at the edge of what we're talking about. As if there was a distinction between the life of the mind and the life of the body. And that goes to the issue of the devaluation of the work, and what makes it so complicated is that, as some of you have said, college is the space that is, in fact, designed for to convert working class kids. And, not, and by the way, I think middle class kids gave me this conversation. But it's designed to convert working class kids into middle class adults. So the whole question of their own identity is quite right in the middle of this.
Has anyone read or do you know anyone who has done research looking at how they are changing the certification process to teach and watering it down where anybody can come teach? Changing the, you know, what is pedagogy, changing what students need, and really forcing out that older generation or the middle generation, and how all that relates to the agenda that they're pushing. But you're not going to have people who are having a voice if you have teachers who aren't teaching, then you should have a voice.
That's right. So I will also say that part of what gets me thinking about all of this, and this is part of the discussion that Tim and I have had, is that so many of our students in our department are planning to become teachers. And they are among the students who are most resistant. When I try to say things like, if you're going to be teaching English, you ought to know where the comma goes. And I know that there are composition people who will call me completely inappropriate for thinking that we should care about where the comma goes. But the idea of achievement for people who want to be teachers, whatever path you follow, because I want them to be teaching your students well instead of coming to my class, it's completely self-serving. Thank you all. We're really glad.